And if you'll turn to Genesis, the 8th chapter, we'll begin there. Some of you are aware of the fact that this morning Agnes Prasino was not feeling well, and her blood pressure, she had said earlier, was 80 over 60, and a number of people encouraged her to go to the hospital. And she did. She was admitted at the ER. And you may recall that she was supposed to have surgery on the 11th. They're going to try to move that up to tomorrow. And remember her in your prayers. She is not doing well. And whenever you have blood pressure that low, you need to do something about it. So I would urge you to remember them. Anthony has had this same sort of sore throat that a number of us have had, and he was having some problems this morning with his throat, but he didn't think he was contagious, and we hope that's true because Agnes certainly doesn't need that. But if you will, turn in your Bibles to the 8th chapter of Genesis. And I might just tell you, brethren, that you know, as you look at these things and you hear me talk about them, I don't regard any of these matters as salvation issues. That is, you can believe whatever you want to about them. But I will tell you that one of the reasons that I like to go over this from time to time is because your children are an important part of our lives, mine and yours. And they are going to be confronted with the questions that I ask on a very regular basis as they get to about their junior year in high school, when they start taking perhaps their freshman year, when they take a course in biology. And then they move on to chemistry is not so bad, but the biology courses in college can get very bad. If they happen to be in geology, most of them will become atheists if they have not heard of these things. And so I encourage you to think about these things, because as you look at them, I can assure you that I have answered these questions, if not hundreds of times, at least tens of times. They have been asked of me as a scientist and as a believer in Jesus Christ who's trained in science. And so as we talk about ways to express this, I'll just tell you that it is my firm conviction that there is no contradiction between the scriptures and science. The problem is bad preachers, poor translations, and scientists who don't know anything about the Bible. And when you get rid of all those things, you look at it and say, oh, this all fits. And we can be confident that it is God's word that we're looking at, and that it's not something that's just some myth that somebody made up. And so at Genesis chapter 8, God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Now you will recall that God took two of every kind and then seven, but that they were to take all the food that the animals needed on the ark. And all the food that they needed, that is the eight people that were there, and they had to take enough for close to a year and a half. You know, the flood lasts a year, and now we're over the flood. He says, the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained. As you start thinking about the fountains of the deep and the water that's there, I will tell you that the kind of storm that this must have generated, because we're not talking about 10 or 12 or 18 inches of water. We're talking about hundreds of feet of water. And I will also tell you something that I learned when I first came to Baltimore. I came as a scientist to study the jellyfish that are out in the bay. And one of the things that happened the year that I came was the Johnstown flood. And it turns out there was enough water dropped up in Pennsylvania, and there was some here too, but The hurricane mainly centered in Johnstown, and it filled the Susquehanna. And the Susquehanna began to move that water downstream. And this was in June. Toward the end of June, we went down for a meeting down at the southern part of Maryland, and actually Gloucester Point, Virginia, the southern part of the Chesapeake Bay. And my immediate supervisor said, you know, the jellyfish are starting to disappear at the Bay Bridge. And they all laughed and they said, of course they are. There's fresh water coming in. Now, you may not realize it or not, but the bay is not fresh. It has about 3 parts per 1,000. The salinity is about the same as the ocean at the end of summer, if it's a dry summer. But the salt water comes up the bottom and then flows out the top, is the way the water currents do, and it moves slowly. And so as you think about this, I was told, if you want jellyfish, you better come back down here. There's about 2 weeks before the water will reach here. Water does not move in the blink of an eye. And so as you start thinking about this, you really need to think seriously about it like an engineer would. How long is it going to take for all that water to run off? Because it doesn't disappear overnight unless God decides to do a miracle. And God doesn't say he did a miracle here. He let the water run down. As we continue then, the water receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. I want you to notice this is taking a long time. In the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. We made reference last week to the fact that Mount Ararat is not the highest mountain in the world, but it is in the world that they inhabited. The inhabited world of that time, it was absolutely the highest. But the ark did not come to rest on Mount Ararat, but in the foothills, evidently, as it says, the mountains of Ararat. The water decreased steadily until the 10th month, and the 10th month on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountain became visible. So this flood had been one of tremendous proportions. Mount Ararat, 12,782 feet. That, according to common geographical technology, is not a mountain. It's a hill. If you learn about mountains, we have a number of them. I believe the number is 54 within the continental United States, but a mountain peak is above 14,000. So as you think about this, these are not exceptionally high mountains, but they are big for the place where they are. And they're about 485 miles from the closest point of the Mediterranean Sea, which is where a lot of this water is going to go. It might flow both ways, and you get some into the Red Sea, but it's about 200 miles north of where Abraham is going to live in the Ur of the Chaldees, which is a modern Nazaria in Iraq. And as I said, flat movement, it flows down the bay in about 3 weeks. Now, we do not live on a hill. You live in the flatlands. And of course, as you think about this, you say, well, all right, it's going to move slowly. Now, the depth at the Bay Bridge is 90 feet. I don't know if all these facts are interesting to you or not, but it's a very deep gully out there. But the water runs out. And by the way, the bay that year went completely fresh. It killed most of the crabs and most of the oysters that were there because they don't survive in fresh water. So it took 150 days for the water to come down for the ark to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And then at verse 6, then it came about at the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark he'd made. And I want you to think about this very carefully here, because what you're going to see is God's wisdom in what Noah sent out. You may not be familiar with doves. I've tried to shoot a lot of them in my time. Doves are fast, but they're ground feeders. A dove can fly at about 60 miles an hour. And if you're not a really good shot with shotgun, you're not going to come home with many doves. But he then sent out a raven. Ravens are much larger and slower birds, but they eat a little bit of everything. And it says, it flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. So she returned to him in the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. Then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark himself. That just means that the water was somewhere between an inch and whatever else, depending upon where they were. Now, we've had a tremendous amount of rain in this area this year, and literally the flood was still in the pastures today. As I looked at it, where it isn't real flat, that water's still standing in puddles because we have so much water that has been raining around here. 70 inches, about 6 feet. Not anything like the flood. For the water was on the surface of the earth. Then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into himself. So he waited another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out from the ark. The dove came to him toward evening, and behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew the water was abated from the earth. So, as I pointed out, doves are ground feeders. They eat seeds, and some species eat some parts of fruits. They will land in trees. Ravens are omnivorous. That is, they eat both flesh. Well, they eat whatever's available. They'll eat worms, you name it, anything, and grain and rotting fruit. So in verses 20 to 22, we find that the Lord, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. We'll talk about that more in just a moment. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. I was interested in this. At what age does the scripture call what you heard preachers talk about the age of accountability? We know that children are innocent. They do not have any part of original sin. You can look at this, and I don't have it in this lesson, but you can write it down in your notes or something. In Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 4, it says, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. And God says, as I live, it shall not be so any longer. So that in verse 20, he comes down and he says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. The sins of the father shall not be upon the son, nor the sins of the son upon the father. There's no such thing as original sin. Children are born completely innocent. What they learn is how you and I behave. They watch carefully. In fact, Cora is now 4. And one of the things that she worries about, because she's heard me say prayers so much, she always asks, did you say nourish? Now, she can barely pronounce nourish, and I have a hard time believing that she knows what it means. Nevertheless, she knows that it's something that I talk about in my prayers as I pray for the food, that it might nourish us. They watch carefully. Don't ever think that they're not watching you just as carefully as they can. So what we learn here is man's character is not sinful at birth, but it develops from observation. So in Proverbs 5 and verse 18, there are a number of ways that you can do this. And by the way, I tell you this because you can just become Bible scholars all on your own. You don't have to wait for me to do it. You can go to that program, that free one, e-sword.net. You can download it. You can also go to the English Standard Version of the Bible, and you can download it, and you can download the Greek background to it, and you don't have as many different versions, but you have good English. And he says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. When a man takes a wife, he's not a babe, he's not an infant. How long does it take children to comprehend what sin is? Well, it's certainly not at birth, but it is by the time they're old enough to get married. Okay? So when you start thinking about when does sin really become real to a child, now they know things that you've said that they shouldn't do, that they shouldn't do. Those are not equivalent to sin before God. They learn that from the time that they're very small, 2 to 3 years old. But as you think about this, all I'm trying to point out is, as you try to define what this word is, and there's no closer way that I can come to it than I can put a limit on it, and that unless it is certainly by the time they are at the point at which they will marry, and I will tell you that from records that we have from the Middle Ages, it turns out that most women married somewhere around the age of 15. They did not start bearing children until they were around 18 because they were not able to do so. That has changed due to changing nutrition, and we have young girls at 12 giving birth now because of this change in nutrition. Another lesson. We're fortunate God's not going to repeat this. Going on to Genesis chapter 9. And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. We have mastery over them, and you realize that this is true. They can overcome that fear. If they're hungry, there are animals that will eat you. And they don't care how big you are, and they probably don't care how many of you there are. But as you think about this, they have been given. And then he says, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. When he says this, he does not give the prescriptions that are given in the law of Moses concerning the kinds of things that they might and might not eat. Those are not given until we actually look into Leviticus. So it's going to be some time before we get there. And as I gave you the green plant, and you can look at your various versions and they'll call it the herb. Literally, it's anything that's green, anything that grows as a plant as opposed to an animal. And he says, I gave to you as I gave the green plant, only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. Again, it is said by some, and the Seventh-day Adventists are really big on this, that God's desire is not for man to eat meat, but for him to eat vegetables and fruits. And they take it from this, well, a passage actually at Genesis chapter 2, verses 29 and 30, that we'll get to in just a moment. But as you start looking at these, one fellow that I was reading said, it is undoubtedly the healthiest diet that a man can have. Don't believe all you read on the internet. It's not. It turns out that those who are vegetarians are deficient in B vitamins, and they're also deficient in red blood cells normally, and they tend to be very small and thin because they do not have good protein. The answer to that is, yeah, you got to eat some of this other stuff. I learned this. My very first job was, Ad and I worked out at W.R. Grayson Company, and I happened to work in an animal nutrition unit that we had at the time, and we were looking at that. And so, yeah, I got to be an expert on pig and chicken, especially chicken nutrition. By the way, if you're familiar with science, we ate the controls, all of them. They were good. But as you think about this, there are certain animals, there are certain bacteria, there are many things that live on protein where vegetables are simply insufficient. If you try to put your dog on a vegetarian diet, it will die. Okay, that's just a statement of fact. You can't do that. They are what are called obligate carnivores, and that means they have to have something, and it turns out there's an amino acid called L-arginine. That's as deep as we're going to go into that. They got to have it, and they don't get it in vegetables. So as you look at this, plants, nevertheless, are the bottom of the food chain. Everything lives off of plants, basically, because as you look at little fuzzy caterpillars, or if you look at worms or something, well, they're eating what's in the soil. It's vegetable detritus. That's vegetable waste stuff, junk. And what happens is that as they do this, Even if you look at a carnivore, he's eating something that's been eating green things. So as I look at this, I understand that the bottom of the food chain is this. God does not want us to be vegetarians. Now, if you want to be a vegetarian, that's just fine. You may have a physical illness. I do. It's better for me not to eat meat. I don't. Y'all probably, most of you know that. There's a reason that I don't do that. It's a medical reason. On the other hand, I will just tell you that if you want to be big and strong and have lots of muscle, you need lots of protein. But if you continue to eat that as you get older, it won't help you anymore. It's a source of a lot of fat. So as you look at diet and the internet, just be aware of these things. But also, just in passing, it turns out that when you start doing pharmaceutical manufacturing, that you have to go into what they call clean rooms. That is, they want you to be like when you're going into, well, much cleaner than when you're going into an operating room. The human body sheds about 200,000 particles an hour. Things drop off of you. And you say, what kind of things? All little scales and pieces of flesh and hair. And you're just shedding all the time, just sort of like a dog that you let in. If you let a dog in your house, you can rest assured it's going to be a whole lot dirtier than if you just let some humans in there. They shed even more. But as you look at this, there are things that take care of those. They eat them. And if you look at bedding, if it's exposed to mites at any time, you can rest assured they'll start to grow. And they will take care. There are normally dust mites and flesh mites in bedding, even if it's washed on a regular basis. So that's one of those things you probably didn't want to know, but they're there, and that's what they eat, is pieces of flesh. So in chapter 9 at verse 5, I'll surely require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. Now, going back to this verse where at verse 4, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. There are times when people go around and they misunderstand this. By the way, if you eat your steaks rare, as a friend of mine once said, that's not hemoglobin, that's myoglobin. In other words, it's not blood. The blood is drained from your purchases at the grocery store. You don't have to worry about that. You can't, unless you do it on a farm or you butcher your own, you're not going to get blood. They're going to have drained that. And every once in a while, somebody say, well, you know, these electrocution is a form of strangulation. By the very fact that I said electrocution, you know it's not strangulation, because in Acts 15, they were forbidden to eat things because of the Jews from things strangled. Things strangled is just that. And there is a lot of this that creeps into Jehovah's Witnesses doctrine. They've decided that transfusions are eating blood. There is a vast difference between what you take into a vein and what happens to it if you put it in your mouth and digest it. All right? If you want a further explanation of that, I can go into as much detail as you would like later. Let me just assure you that you're not eating blood if you get a transfusion. Now, there are some rules about transfusions, and, you know, one of the things that we hope is that Agnes doesn't have to have any, and if she does, that she doesn't have to have many. Fortunately, the care of blood has been improved greatly even in the past 30 years. In 1980, it was not possible. Well, they just shut off blood donations by people who were on drugs or likely to do drugs, or people who were not heterosexuals. And the reason was they knew you were going to get illnesses and they couldn't identify those. And so blood is basically, as you think about it, it's extremely important when it comes to you. And God puts an emphasis on here. He says, I don't want you eating that. Now, there's another reason for that. And that is, if you ever take a course in microbiology and you want to culture, that is to grow some nasty bugs, you do it on what are called blood agar plates. And the reason that they do that, they usually take sheep blood or something like that, and they'll put the red cells in there, and they want to know if you have something that's going to wipe out the red cells. And if you do, it's really bad. That's how you know that it's really bad. And you can grow really bad things on blood. That's why they were forbidden to eat it from Exodus 15 and verse 26. Here, God says, you don't eat it. It's the life. And he wanted to establish a principle. So in Genesis 9, verses 5 and 6, he says the blood is so important that you don't kill anyone. That we could get the people of, well, in any major city, I don't mean to pick on Baltimore. I don't need to pick on them all the time because they have the same kind of problems that you see. Well, D.C. outdid us last year. Their murder rate was even higher. Chicago sometimes comes in very close to the Baltimore murder rate. But you do realize that there is no care for life among a large segment of our current population. They have no knowledge of God, and they do not care about His Word. When you go overseas and you see the wars that are going on, as I talked just a little bit about it this morning, there are so many wars going on, and it's really over. My tribe is going to run this place. Reminds me of what's going on with the government shutdown right now. We're going to run this place. We're in control now, and we're going to run this place. Whatever you think about that, I will tell you that's exactly what's going on in the Middle East, except they're killing a lot of people. A huge number of people, thousands, 300 per day. We'll put it that way. So God said capital punishment is required right here. It's set down before even the law of Moses is given. It's required there. The current situation in the law of most states is opposed to this. They have decided that it is not a deterrent to crime and it is not of value to take someone's life who has taken another man's life. I would urge you as Christians to think carefully about what you do and how you reflect on the laws of the land where you are when compared with the laws of God. Then he comes to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 7. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. There was a man named Malthus back in the 1600s, and he said, we're all going to starve to death in another 50 years or something, 100 years, something like that. He said, we can't support the population that we have. Human technology, as directed by what God has previously done, has allowed us to come to a point at which the earth now supports many more billions than men ever thought possible. If you reflect for just a moment on every war that was fought up until World War II, up until after World War II, they were all fought over land and food, every one of them. We need more land for our people and more food. Hitler wanted what the Germans call Lebensraum, room to live. And we now no longer need to do that. There was a nice agronomist named Norman Borlaug, who figured out that rust decreased wheat yields by about 70 to 90%. And so he developed rust-resistant wheat. We now have enough bread to feed the whole world and then some. We're all overweight in this country. Well, 90% of us, 95% of us, something like that. Another thing that he did is he looked at rice. And he said, rice is a dwarf rice. And if you have dwarf rice, it doesn't fall over. But if you have long stem rice, which is the kind most people grow, what happens is if it gets a problem, it bends over at the middle. And when it does, it dips into the water and the head doesn't develop. No rice grows. He was able to develop this dwarf rice, and it turns out that he increased the yield of rice by about a factor of 10. And what you're doing, what you're saying there is, what you're seeing is that man's technology is guided by the fact that men want to help others. I'd like to point out to you that you may pay a lot for your medicines and such. Well, what men are trying to do is they're trying, and they need to make money up for it. That's their right according to the Scriptures. But what they're trying to do is to help others. I want you to notice the difference between this country and every other country of the world. I have worked for foreign corporations, and I'm fairly certain of what I talk about here. They do it for the money, and they come to the United States for the market, and that's where they get the ability to pay for the drug and the drug research that they do. They don't do that research out of an altruistic, that is, a desire to help mankind. They do it out of a desire to make money. In the United States, I will tell you that because of the light that shines from Christian, there is a desire to help others. I'll illustrate it this way. When I was working for the French, they said they were amazed at how much blood the United States gave. And I looked at them and I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, you give blood in the United States." I said, "Well, doesn't every country give blood?" They said, "Oh, no, no." I said, "You don't understand. That makes you weaker. They don't donate blood like you do here in the United States. That's something that you do to help your fellow man. And they do not do that. Not in any other country of the world. In fact, in France, the way they get the blood products that they need, the serum, the antibodies, the albumin and things that they give you when you go into a hospital, they ask, they don't ask, they tell the hospitals, we'll buy the placentas from those births. And so when a child is born in South America, in Africa, if they are in a hospital, the placenta from the child is taken and it's thrown in a stainless steel bucket. And then it's frozen. And the company that I work for had a plant in Lyon, France, that could do 15,000 tons a day of placental tissue. You think about that. That's a bunch of placental tissue. They chopped it up. They minced it. They put it through a process to isolate the blood fractions, and they sold them worldwide. The only place you can get blood products from, if you need whole hemoglobin, they can only get serum and antibodies and such as that from it. But if you need that, you have to get it from a U.S., like the Red Cross. You wonder if you should help those folks? That's the only way that the world gets those. And I assure you that I can show you the data in research papers and such. There are people who say, "Well, you're just being racist about all those other countries." I'm not. Been there. Done that. I know what I'm talking about. And let me just tell you that the blood is important. How much is needed? At times, there are times when we run out. One of the things I pointed out, I pray that Agnes is not going to need any. But if her surgeries go wrong and there's something that needs to be taken care of, she may need that, and she'll need that which is pure. It's life-saving. When God said the life is in the blood, believe me, it may have been centuries ago, but he knew exactly what he was talking about. And it's so true. You can talk to any scientist who works in the blood industry that you want to, and they'll say, "Yeah, that's the situation. The life is in the blood." It's such an important thing that we need to point out to our children that there are so many people in the world who don't realize that these little simple statements that are here show us that God revealed His will to mankind, and then it was written down in the Scriptures for us that through those things we might show that Jesus is the Christ. The next one that comes up, people get upset, but Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. One of the things that happens on grapes, and I'll conclude this real shortly, is a grape has the highest number of yeast growing on the skin of any fruit. If you want to isolate yeast, that's the stuff that makes alcohol. And in fact, if you go into a orchard, not an orchard, but a vineyard, late in the year, or if you have some grapes growing in your arbor, and you go in there, and as the grapes start to pucker, that's when they're real ripe, they draw back from the stem. And when they do, the sugars that are in the grape, which are very highly active, begin to get that yeast that's there. Now, as long as there's air, the yeast makes more yeast. But as soon as the air is cut off, as it penetrates the grape, it starts to make alcohol. Now, as you look at that, you may or may not like that, but it's a natural product. It grows naturally. We know that drunkenness is a sin. You can drink too much of it, even if it's not very strong. I'll tell you that most home vintners don't get above 6.5%, which is not enough for you to get drunk real easily on. You've got to spend some time at it. But as you consider this, nevertheless, again, what I see here is a point at which God just in passing refers to something that anthropologists and such immediately say, well, this is when men began to stop being hunter-gatherers and to start locating in a particular place and farming and taking care of animals. Now, if you read Genesis 10, there's a bunch of names in there. And in Peleg, it says the earth was divided. And I point out some translators believe it looks forward to the division of languages at Babel, which happens in the next chapter. It certainly does not refer to the division of continents. They couldn't have told whether it was or not. They had no way of knowing. The name Peleg actually means divided. So there was a split in the earth. We don't know how big it was, but there was one. It was not the division of continents. In Genesis chapter 11, the same earth, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. Well, as you go on, it says they decided to build a tower. And they spoke at verse 6, they are one people and they all have the same language. That's of extreme interest to me as a person looking for evidence that the Bible knows what it's talking about. God said, let's go down and confuse their speech, and they decided for men to go across the face of the earth. I want to just point something out to you. This is what's called a geolinguistic map. And what it does is it says, and they believe it's down here in the Olduvai Gorge, but you'll notice that the branches that come off are right up here around where Ur of the Chaldees is. They don't have any data to show that that is different, except that the Olduvai Gorge, where the Leakeys are, and if you ever ask about this, you can point out to them, well, that's just one of the driest places on the earth, and there's never been any chance for anything to ever rot. And so those bones are still there. There were no animals to bother them, and that's why they're finding old bones there. In places where it rains, you don't get that kind of thing. You don't get it down here. I mean, you have to be in real dry country to get those things. Now, another thing that happens, that was a language map. This is a DNA map. And one of the things that always amazes me as I start looking at these things, they say they go right back over here and notice where the branches are. And they say, well, look, they came off down here. They don't know that. What they know is that right up here, about where the Garden of Eden is where everything starts to branch out. And what you find is, the further you get from that, you can trace the lineage of people. And what it says is exactly what the Bible is saying there. There was an origin place, and it was over there where we're looking at it, right here in Genesis. And as you look at this, you say, well, what was the last one? You know, the last one to get settled. You look over here South America. But as you start looking at North America there, you say, well, okay, they know it was later there. Let me just point out to you, what they're doing is they're illustrating exactly what God said right here. This is not something that you need to be worried about, that you need to say, oh, they're teaching our kids all this stuff. It shows that the Bible is true. And so the language maps coincide with the DNA maps, which is what you would expect. And it says there was a point at which God said, all these people are going to get scattered abroad. Science coincides with the Bible on the origin and the spread of languages. And the people from near where God said it happened. They draw all these things. They come real close. But now they do know that there's supposed to be a center over here in Mesopotamia, and they would like to avoid that. Let me just point out that what we have shown in this short time is that indeed the Word of God is true. If you're here and you believe that God is, that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him, I would ask you to turn your face toward God, to seek His will, to do His will. We know that He gave His only begotten Son for us that we might have everlasting life. If you're here, you would like to avail yourself of the opportunity to respond to the gospel. We would encourage you to let us know as together we stand and we sing.